This feature of the Science News Radio Network is coming to you from our studios in Dallas, Texas. Science News is on the air right now.
This is the promise of tomorrow, where people and industry keep up with the business of emerging and nanotechnologies. The fields covered in this series of programs will include energy, defense, aerospace, medicine, semiconductors, and more. For the next hour, Colonel Mason will introduce his experts, and you'll be on the cutting edge of the promise of tomorrow.
And hey, you all, so good to have you back with us again as we explore the exciting world of the business of emerging science, nanotechnology, open innovation, homeland security. Yes, we're getting a lot of coverage to the IEEE Homeland Security Technology Conference going on in Boston, Massachusetts, April 14 through 16. The date is approaching rapidly. You can learn more about it at IEEE, that's IEEE-HST.org, or go to our website, promiseoftomorrow.biz. On the right-hand side of your screen, you'll see a link. I want to remind those of you who are listening on radio that you can also hear us commercial-free online and webcast at promiseoftomorrow.biz, that same website that I just told you about where you can find the information on the IEEE Homeland Security Technology Conference. I have a very exciting show today. In covering Homeland Security, we're so concerned about terrorists and explosives and chemicals and all sorts of things. Well, Bruker Detection Corporation, an international organization, has got some solutions that are pretty exciting because they're very, very portable. And we're going to talk about that with Frank Thibodeau, who is VP of Business Development for Bruker Detection Corporation internationally. He says they've already got some customers for these things in Germany and some other stuff, and you're going to really enjoy meeting him. And then we're going to touch on the controversial subject of climate change. As you probably know, it reports out of Europe all the time about how the stringent measures that are being taken to get rid of fossil fuels. Coal has been a big thing, in Europe. And there's all sorts of moves to move away from that and to go to alternative energy. The problem is that it's really raised the energy costs for an awful lot of people and caused a lot of hardships. So people are always trying to debunk the climate change, the global warming theories that are so gaining steam, every day. And of course, in this country too, in the United States, we see that the concern over it. It's an incredible subject, and so one of the things is a debunking of the models that are being shown to show what's going on with climate change. All the time, scientists are coming forward and saying, "Hey, those models don't mean anything." So we went back and dug up an interview that we did with Stephen Schneider, who's been a climatologist at Stanford University since 1970. He's now the late Stephen Schneider, died of a heart attack a few years back. But we talked to him in 2009, and he explained about how those models are working. So we're gonna pull that back. I have kind of an encore review with the late Dr. Stephen Schneider. So, but right now, let's get to our very interesting interview with Frank Thibodeau. Well, in the intriguing world of terrorists and the great underworld that's going on, we're always concerned about explosive detections, chemical detection. It's always been such an elusive thing. Well, Bruker Detection Corporation believes they've got some pretty exciting solutions. And so we ran down Frank Thibodeau, who is a chief of development for business development for Bruker Detection. He's with us right now. And welcome to the program, Frank.
Thank you very much for having me.
Tell us some of the exciting things that that you're going to be showing at the IEEE Homeland Security Technology Conference that's going to be coming up in the middle of April.
Yes, we have some new products we're going to introduce to the market. First of all, our new radiation detection backpack, which is isotope ID, and with neutron detection included. And this is a brand new development that we just had tested for by the government and did very well. We're providing this to Homeland Security responders, to the military, and what have you, to be able to interdict possible nuclear weapons or radiation instruments that are, let's say, could be used, a radiological dispersion device we call RDD. It's a very sensitive, very quick, fast, and easy to operate backpack system that gives you the means to portably just walk around and search and find things, and then when you're covering important events or to protect critical infrastructure.
All right, well, I'm kind of getting a picture of this. This is a back. This all could be done with a single person. You don't have to have a team, and it works on as a backpack. So that would mean that it's somewhat light. How heavy is this thing?
It'll be about 22 pounds. Fairly light and easy to use. It can be used with one person, but it's actually much more effective in a team approach with multiple systems throughout covering an area.
All right, and so this largely you would use on vehicles, I guess. What, you have some sort of a probe or something that you move over a particular area? What about people? You could detect on people, I suppose, as well as vehicles. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right. And all you do is just walk around with it. It'll talk to you, tell you what it is. It'll distinguish between the background, between medical procedures that might have happened with people that are walking around. It'll distinguish industrial type of radioactive materials and even nuclear materials that our terrorists might be using.
So you don't have to send this off to the cloud anywhere and wait to get back. This thing will actually speak to us as the operator walks around and points the wand at whatever it is he's pointing it at?
Yeah, he doesn't even have to point at anything. And he can be just doing it from an earphone. It'll just talk to him directly. Hands-free operation. It talks directly to the person there. It can be networked into a command and control system that people in back in the control room or the headquarters can see what's happening at the same time.
Oh, I see. So it'll send a signal not only to the operator and speak to the operator, but it'll send a signal back to a command center. And you don't use a wand then. All you have to do is be in the vicinity?
That's correct.
Wow.
Targets can be moving. You can be moving, or you can be stationary, whatever the case might be. It works just as well.
Wow. Is it classified information as to how close you have to be to the particular subject, or is there a way of confusion? I mean, supposing you're standing near a suspect or a car or something like that, and another one comes by, can it confuse between the two targets?
Well, it's very fast and very sensitive. It's a fairly good size detector inside the backpack. So it's made to be able to detect very quickly very small sources, even if they're shielded. There's a limit to everything that you could possibly do, of course, but something moving too fast, could probably not be caught. But normal speeds and with people, pedestrians, and what have you, and even on vehicles going by slowly, it can detect what's in there and give the answer to the operator or to the command center very quickly.
All right, now I'm trying to really get a good picture of this. Neutron detection, explosives detection, chemical detection. I mean, this is kind of covering the waterfront here. Do you have to dial, turn a dial when you're looking for explosives and then turn another dial when you want to go after chemicals, or it will differentiate?
This backpack will not do explosives. No, that's a different instrument. This backpack will only do gamma and neutron, radioisotope ID, and nuclear material detection in one. That's it.
Okay, well, you also have a unit then, a separate unit, that will do explosives. Can you tell us about that?
We have a couple of different new systems being introduced that will go into testing at TSA later this year. One of them is a desktop for the, you know, that's the traditional airport screen device that looks for explosives by wiping materials, clothes, hands, and stuff like that. You've seen that at many airports.
Mm-hmm.
We have that one. And we also have a new handheld that's being introduced later in the year that is much more lighter weight and actually has better detection technology. Not only does it do trace with wiping, but it also does has a sniffer on it to detect volatile type of explosive materials.
So this is a sniffer in a wand type of thing where someone at an airport or in an area where they think there could be somebody with explosives packed to their body, you can get close to these people and it will actually sniff the smell of the explosives. Is that it?
Yeah, the improvised explosives that could be triggered in a backpack or something like that, as you know from prior events that have happened overseas. And it also has being able to wipe it down and do much more extensive analysis of solid explosive residue in a portable instrument. So you can move this around and go and do quite a bit of throughput with people or baggage or cargo, stuff like this. And a portable, lightweight system allows you to really be flexible in where you're going to try to detect explosives.
I would think there'd be an incredibly large market for this stuff. You're selling it domestically, but I bet you get a lot of takers in Israel and in fact is everywhere overseas. I would think the European Union, Ukraine, maybe even Russia would be interested in this equipment.
Well, absolutely, and in fact, the tabletop ones that were just into production with, we sold some to Germany in the airport, German airports just recently, 50 to 100 units. So that's our first sale into the market. Very exciting. So looking forward to more throughout the world.
So you've got a lot of traveling ahead of you if you're going to sell both domestically and overseas. Are there any, since it's a defensive unit and not offensive, I suppose there's not a whole lot of restrictions from the government over where you can sell these units. Is that right?
That's right. There's less restrictions than other instruments you would think of, for sure. However, it has to get certification and... Our tabletop did get European certification just recently, and then we made sales right after that. And we're looking to get certification in the U.S. Later this year, early next year, and then also with the handheld as well, go through testing with that. And that one's a little bit a little later in the year, but tabletop is much closer to reality.
Okay. Is there a website where people can go to see photos of what this looks like and get maybe a deeper understanding, or are they going to have to count on you coming and making a presentation personally at their site?
Well, we do have sales brochures that go in generalities about the instruments, and those can be found at Bruker.com under defense or submarine defense, or you can go to BrukerDetection.com as well and get to the detection devices a little quicker.
All right. Well, for the sake of our listeners, Bruker is spelled D-R-U-K-E-R, and, of course, detection.com then would be the website, and people can learn more about what they're going to see at the IEEE Homeland Security Technology Conference at our website, promiseoftomorrow.biz, on the right-hand side of the screen. Just click on the icon, and it'll take you right to the IEEE Homeland Security website, of which Bruker will be there making some demonstrations and talking to customers. It's a very, very exciting thing that you're doing, Frank. I really appreciate you coming on the program and telling us more about it. What have we missed? What have I not asked you?
Well, you know, a history of Bruker a little bit in detection business. You know, we've been in business over 30 years to federal government mm-hmm. In Europe and the United States, And we developed the first mobile mass spectrometer. We went on to do other things like standoff detection for chemical, point detection for chemical. We've had a lot of success in various areas around the world. Most notably, we provide chemical detection to the entire U.S. Navy surface fleet. We provide handheld chemical detection to military first responders around the world and to the National Guard response teams that you find all over the country.
Mm-hmm.
So we've had quite a bit of success in other areas. This is where we grew up in and have developed our business, and now we're branching off into explosive detection and radiation detection, and we look forward to it, much success in the future in that.
Well, you're headquartered, I think, in Massachusetts. Did you tell me that? And did you?
Yep. We're a U.S. Company traded on NASDAQ. Our international headquarters is in Billerica, Massachusetts,
mm-hmm.
on Manning Road. We have a campus here with five companies represented in five different buildings, and quite a bit of operation. Our company, our parent company, which we are included, of course, is about $2 billion turnover every year.
Oh, wow. Major operation, and we're sure proud to have you here on the program. I really appreciate you taking the time to be with us. Can you look down the road maybe 5-10 years or so? Give us a prediction of what you see maybe coming in the future, either in your specialized field or maybe anything that you've been kind of looking at lately that may be coming down our way 5, 10, even 20 years.
Well, that's a very good point. We are involved in research and development projects for both the military, Department of Defense, and the Department of Homeland Security. And 5 to 10 years down the road, I can see us, as long as those things work out well, successfully, and we come up with a great product, and I think we will. It looks very exciting to have new mobile mass specs in the field. Well, I think number one, listen to the customer. What do they want? What do they need? What can we provide and develop in order to meet their needs as best we can within, the fiscal constrictions and stuff like that. So listening to the customer and following the needs of the market is very, very important.
Okay. Frank Thibodeau, most generous of your time. We appreciate so much you being with us, and we'll look forward to seeing you at the IEEE Homeland Security Technology Conference in the middle of April, the 14th through the 16th, in Boston. And thanks so much for being with us.
Oh, thank you.
Okay, Frank. Okay, on to our continuing study of global warming. Our dear friend in London, Benny Pizer, tells us that there's so much controversy going on over the hardships that are being caused by the change from fossil fuels over to renewables in Europe, that there's a number of people trying to debunk the whole modeling that is being used to prove that global warming is existing. So we dug back to our archives and we found this encore interview with the late Stephen Snyder. We're fortunate today to have with us Stephen Snyder. Now, among other things, he's professor for interdisciplinary environmental studies at Stanford University, but he's internationally recognized for research in climate change. He specializes in climate science and has consulted with federal agencies and or the White House staff, and going back as far as Nixon, includes Carter and Reagan and the first George Bush, Clinton, the newly retired Bush administration. But, Steve, I don't see the Obama administration in there anywhere. Do you not consult with them?
My vita is reflects the status of a standard professor with insufficient administrative help. We just haven't updated it yet. Yes, I have two or three very good friends in the administration, and even though I've been talking with them for years and they don't really need to call me to get my advice once in a while, they do. So I've been talking with people literally inside the White House, too.
Okay, well, I want our listeners to know that you've been actively involved with the IPCC, the International Panel on Climate Change.
with United Nations, of course, environmental program. But I recently, you kind of took issue with some of the things that they're doing. You co-authored Uncertainties in the IPCC Third Assessment Report. Are you having some issues with them?
Well, there's no person, place, or thing that's perfect in anyone's opinion. And I think the IPCC has done about as good a job as it was capable of doing, given the circumstances, that it operates on the basis of consensus. By that I mean about 120 countries get together and they approve the reports, and they have to go over the summary for policymakers word for word. Well, how are you going to end up getting precisely the language the scientists want when you've got, you know, countries like the small island states facing extinction of their culture and being driven off the islands as the sea level rises, who want the report stronger, and then fossil fuel dependent countries like China and Russia and OPEC and the U.S. and Australia, who are very careful to keep the report a little bit less scary. So what it ends up being is a lowest common denominator in sort of the middle, cuts off the edges, you know, the extreme concern and the happy world. But the chapters written by the authors don't do that. It's just a summary for policymakers. My complaint that was reported in the New York Times is that scientists, by and large, are a culture of conservatives. I don't mean political conservatives. I mean that they are evidence-driven, and therefore they generally withhold opinions until they have a lot of accumulated evidence. I'm one of those guys, too. However, we are operating through the IPCC at the request of 120 governments who don't want us to wait until we have a consensus before we warn them of potential risks. They want us to tell them everything. But I keep arguing consensus is not about conclusions, that is, how many degrees warming is going to be. Consensus is how much confidence the legitimate scientific community has in those conclusions. And those things that we know well, we should say so. And those things that are speculative, we should say so. We shouldn't just put next to each other a strong affirmative statement and then, oh, but we don't know anything about precipitation in Kansas, even though both of those are true. We know it's going to warm, and we don't know what's going to happen to precipitation in Kansas because our confidence levels are completely different. Precipitation in Kansas, we have very low confidence in. That it's going to warm, we have high confidence in. So I've been arguing with my colleagues to be a little bit more forthcoming about the range of what can happen, but to be absolutely clear when we don't have a lot of good knowledge that that's the case. And it's society's choice to judge whether or not it wishes to take the risk, just like it's individuals' choices how much insurance to buy. There's no right answer. That's a political value judgment about whether you fear more investing present resources in a problem that may not be as bad as we think, or whether you fear more not investing to slow down a problem that could come out worse than we think. And there's no right answer. And I keep telling my scientist colleagues, it's not our judgment to choose whether to be conservative or not in that. We just tell everything and give our confidences. And that's a hard pill for some of my colleagues to swallow, because they've been raised in the notion that we don't talk about it till we know for sure. And I think that's actually making a political judgment for society that's inappropriate. That's been my argument with IPCC. It's not been over the quality of the scientific assessment or the openness of the process. It's been, in fact, that we've been too inside the club and haven't been forthcoming enough about the wide range of possibilities, good and bad, that can come out there until we have very, very high degrees of evidence, and that shouldn't be our judgment alone.
Fascinating. And we'll be back with more questions for the late, great Stephen Snyder right after the break. Okay, as we walk to the break at the half hour, we're going to pause at the door of the Den of Strangers, where we keep locked away all of the wisdom of mankind. In the Den of Strangers, will we meet today?
Andre Moreau. I listen to an adversary with the dangerous desire to understand him.